Good morning, and may it please the Court, Matthew Bergman, appearing on behalf of the Stevens family. With me at council tables is Ms. Ruby Aliment. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Under Oregon law, in a toxic tort case, a plaintiff is entitled to rely upon circumstantial evidence in establishing the fundamental issues of causation and exposure. Oregon Supreme Court has recognized that in reaching this determination, expert testimony is almost always required, and that, in the words of the Idaho Supreme Court, judges should afford substantial deference to a qualified expert's selection of the facts on which he bases his opinion and avoid second-guessing the facts on which the expert chose to rely. In this case, it is very clear that the district court relied solely on the direct evidence set forth in Mr. Stevens' testimony and did not consider the circumstantial evidence consisting of Union Pacific's corporate admissions and documents and the expert testimony submitted in this case. We would agree that standing alone, Mr. Stevens' testimony that he observed insulation being removed in his father's proximity from locomotives would not be sufficient to establish a fact issue on exposure or causation. But read in conjunction with and connecting the dots to the other evidence in this case, we believe that inference is appropriately reached. Particularly, Union Pacific admitted that the locomotives that were repaired at the Weezer facility were insulated with asbestos. Union Pacific admitted that insulation would be repaired and replaced in the course of regular and anticipated maintenance. And finally, that this activity would create dust. So viewed in the context of Mr. Stevens' testimony that he observed insulation work going on, that establishes a fact issue that asbestos products were actually being used. Now, combine that with the expert testimony of Dr. Longo that in the two-stall garage or facility that the work was going on, the roundhouse, anybody in the work area would have been exposed within 276 feet. Dr. Longo established through his expert testimony, which was not rejected by the district court, which is before the court, that whether or not Mr. Rowley Stevens actually worked with the material, being present in the work environment, would have contaminated his clothes. And furthermore, that the home environment would have been contaminated. Dr. Longo referred to this as chronic.
Counsel, can I ask you about that? Because both Dr. Longo and your other expert, Dr. Churd,
yes,
predicated their analysis on an assumption about the frequency of exposure, and I don't know where you got that.
The frequency.
Well, I mean, there was a reference to sort of daily exposure to the dust, and I'm wondering, you know, what is there in Mr. Stevens' testimony or any of the admissions from UP that you're referring to?
Well, as the court held in Earl, we need to connect the dots here, and the dots consist of Mr. Stevens' testimony that insulation work was performed, that his father came home daily with dusty work clothes, and you combine that with Union Pacific's admission that the locomotives contained asbestos, and this was a key document, routine maintenance of that locomotive involved disturbance of insulation. And finally, Dr. Longo's testimony that the entire work area that would have been contaminated. And so in terms of frequency, Your Honor, we have 40 hours a week for 10 years.
But there are a lot of activities that produce dust that don't necessarily involve insulation or asbestos. So I guess I'm not sure how you get from the testimony of somebody who was a child at the time,
right,
saying that his father was sometimes dusty, to the conclusion that work with asbestos-containing dust was a daily occurrence.
Yes, and I don't believe the record would support a daily occurrence, Your Honor, to be candid with you. But I believe it can be reasonably inferred that regular work with asbestos was encompassed within the maintenance work performed in the Weezer facility. And moreover, based upon Dr. Longo's testimony, whether or not the work was actually performed on a daily basis, and I don't think the record supports that. The work environment was contaminated, and just through the process of re-entrainment, which Dr. Longo described asbestos being re-lofted into the atmosphere, it would have resulted in contamination. It is a question, most assuredly, of connecting the dots, but we believe the dots are there, particularly in light of the deference that Idaho courts require be paid to the experts, essentially selection of facts.
Can you tell me what specifically in the record you're referring to on in terms of Union Pacific's admissions? Because I read I thought the pages you cited in the brief, carefully avoiding saying that they, it sounded like they really didn't know what work was done there.
Well, they didn't have specific knowledge on Weezer. Yes, Your Honor, that is manifestly correct. But excerpt of record 339 to 41 is an admission by their 30B6 designee that the locomotives were insulated with asbestos, and that removal and replacement of that insulation was a routine activity at UP maintenance facilities. Furthermore, ER 419, they admitted that this activity would have created dust. And so as a result, Your Honor, I think we have evidence that admissions from Union Pacific that their locomotives had prodigious amount of dust. Moreover, Your Honor, just looking at the demonstratives that Mr. Stevens testified were representative of what he saw, one can just look at those huge locomotives that's in the actual briefs, encased in asbestos.
You're talking about the photographs?
I am, Your Honor, yes, which were concededly not taken of Weezer, but which the evidence supported the conclusion that they were representative of what he saw. This is, I think, an example where, and there is a paucity of direct asbestos appellate authority in Idaho, but the Idaho court has cited approvingly of the Washington Supreme Court's decision in Lockwood, which I know Judge Rothstein is familiar with. And essentially what we have, I believe, is a similar situation as was presented to the Washington Supreme Court in Lockwood. Albert Lockwood had worked in the hold of the USS George Washington, having no idea what asbestos was used or whether it even was asbestos. But what the Washington Supreme Court held in Lockwood was that a plaintiff can rely on other evidence to establish that key factor, other evidence. And that's exactly what we have here. There is no question that Mr. Stevens does not have personal knowledge, direct knowledge. But the evidence here, Your Honors, is if you look at the court's opinion, it does not appear that the court granted any attention or any weight whatsoever to the Union Pacific documents, both the corporate admission testimony and their repair specification that said you've got to replace insulation as part of this process, completely ignored that, as well as completely ignored the expert testimony, which under Idaho law needs to be given substantial deference to.
At the risk of taking you away from the argument that you're making, I'd like to raise the question of foreseeability.
Of course.
And where that stands, how you see where that stands in the record now.
Well, I think this court, should it choose to do so, could affirm on alternative grounds. The trial court found that foreseeability was a question of fact. Now,
where do you see that?
It's in the court's, in the oral argument transcript.
Where in the oral argument transcript do you find a finding by the trial court that that is a question of fact?
It was a statement from the bench in the course of the oral argument.
There was a question from the bench in the course of oral argument, but I would like to see where you find a statement from the bench that it was in fact a question of fact.
I will come back to you on my rebuttal time with that, Judge. But on the substance.
Yeah. On the substance, what do you do about Hoyt?
Well, first of all, what you do about Hoyt is, first of all, it's obviously not authoritative. And the record before the court, it is authoritative, it is not controlling. I'm sorry, Judge. The record before Hoyt was a very, very limited record that did not contain the factual evidence that was put forward before the district court here regarding foreseeability. In particular, and remember that Union Pacific has acknowledged that a duty is owed. The scope of the duty is essentially the scope of the duty is determined by foreseeability. What was not in the record in Hoyt was the extensive analysis over the course of 100 years of medical and industrial hygiene literature regarding the knowledge. And let me just be very, very brief. You know, you had two strains of knowledge. None of this was in the record in Hoyt. Starting with Tallman in 1913, a recognition that in the industrial hygiene literature, segregation of work clothes and street clothes was good industrial hygiene policy. And you also have established, unlike in Hoyt, from the 1935 on, Union Pacific was a member of the American Association of Railroads. Its personal physician, or its company physician, attended meetings discussing asbestos hazards. Moving forward, you have the Alton Railroad, which was a subsidiary of Union Pacific. In the 1940s, utilizing very extensive safety measures. And with the specific issue, Your Honor, and I think this is where you're going on respect to take-home exposure risks, you have two kind of clarion calls, if you would, as to when it became known or knowable. And let me just, you know, interject that under Idaho law, you know, the cardinal negligence principle that only the general risk of harm need to be foreseen, not the specific mechanism of injury. So with that preface in mind, within industry, the key date is 1942, when the Pennsylvania Department of Labor reported on General Electric's utilization of industrial hygiene mechanisms, basically lockers and change rooms. And then in 1949, the National Cancer Institute and the National Institute of Health finding A, asbestos is a carcinogen, and B, you prevent it by having segregated work clothes and
but
street
just
clothes.
Like in Hoyt, the experts here agreed there were no published studies about this kind of derivative harm from clothing and dust, take-home harm, right?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, that's not what's in Mr. Templin's. What is true is that the first published literature regarding the connection of take-home asbestos or secondary asbestos and mesothelioma was 1960, the Wagner study. But the 1949 study, the Hooper study by the National Cancer Institute, specifically referenced cancer, lung cancer in general. And again, under Idaho law, the question is the general field of danger. And it was very, you know, the evidence that was put forward, and there was no evidence on the other side, but the evidence that was put forward in this case was that through its involvement in the American Association of Railroads, Union Pacific was, you know, had every opportunity to be aware that asbestos was being used prominently in its repair facilities and knew about the basic industrial hygiene measures to protect workers from that. And that is established in the record. Moreover, you have this extensive body of literature going on, you know, starting in 1913 and going through the 40s and 50s, recognizing that not only are workers exposed to toxic dust at risk, but their families are exposed, and that the way you protect them is to have separate lockers and separate change rooms so you segregate work clothes and street clothes. There's no evidence this was done here.
Well, if you're taking the position that the trial court has already ruled on this and found it a dispute of fact, so you're not asking us to do so, to rule on this at all, or are you?
Well, Judge, it was an alternative ground on which, you know, the court could find with us on the causation issue and affirm an alternative ground. So I am essentially suggesting that the court decline to do so, that the evidence before this record would allow a reasonable trier of fact to conclude that it was foreseeable. And again, foreseeability under Idaho law is always a question of fact unless reasonable minds could only reach one thing. I believe that the record we put forward before this court and before the district court would allow reasonable minds to conclude that the general field of danger of take-home asbestos exposure was knowable to Union Pacific in the 40s and 50s. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Very good. Okay, let's hear from counsel for Union Pacific.
Good morning, Steve Crane for Union Pacific Railroad Company. I'd like to focus my comments on the actual evidence on the two key issues that we think are dispositive of this appeal. One is exposure, and two, substantial factor. Let me start with exposure, which itself has two parts. One, the father's exposure, and two, then exposure to the plaintiff from the father's exposure. So what is the actual evidence on the father's exposure? There is no evidence that the father worked or cut insulation himself. There is no evidence that the father worked around anyone else who cut insulation, or what his proximity was to any work on insulation by others.
Could you just pause there, the sure. First part of that. There's no evidence that he worked around others who were cutting insulation?
Correct.
I thought the plaintiff's testimony here was that he went to his father's workplace and he saw, I guess he was watching his father as well, but he saw people doing that, no?
No, that's not the testimony, and I'll get to that in just a second because I want to pick up through a logical progression of this. But I don't think that's the actual testimony. There's no evidence of what the operation was conducted as to insulation, how it was conducted, how often it was conducted. There's simply an absence of information in the record on that. The totality of the evidence, and this gets to Your Honor's question, the totality of the evidence with respect to operations regarding insulation was that the plaintiff recalls when he was somewhere between 6 and 8 years old, once seeing insulation being removed and replaced. That's it.
Okay, and so why doesn't that testimony alone counter the first part of that statement that I paused you on?
Because there's no evidence of what that removal or replacement entailed, and where the plaintiff's father was in relation to that. What we do know from affirmative testimony from Union Pacific's person most knowledgeable deponent was that the only time asbestos might, and I emphasize might, be disturbed is in a major overhaul situation. And even in that circumstance, it depends on how the worker did the work on whether the lagging, which may have contained asbestos, was disturbed to the point the asbestos fibers were released. But that's all speculation. We don't know, for example, when the plaintiff observed work on insulation the one time he was there, whether that was a major overhaul. And that's the problem with counsel's argument this morning, that there was this repair work constantly going on and that somehow creates asbestos dust. That's not the testimony. The actual testimony is only a major overhaul might, depending on the circumstances, result in asbestos being disturbed. But there's no evidence that it was a major overhaul at that time. So the totality of the evidence as to the father's exposure is simply an absence of evidence and speculation that the father himself took home asbestos on his clothing. Without that premise, the plaintiff's argument and contention that he was then exposed while his mother did laundry has no foundation. But let's assume some exposure to the father, which is speculation. There's no evidence of how often the plaintiff was on the porch where the laundry was done and there's no evidence of his proximity to where the laundry was being done. And even speculating that the one time the plaintiff observed the operation on the insulation, and even assuming the father was in sufficient proximity, and even assuming the insulation was cut and disturbed, there's no evidence that that event on that day was the same day that the plaintiff was at home on the porch while his mother was doing the laundry.
Yes, but I think the inference the plaintiff is saying a jury could draw here is that the insulation removal and replacement work that he observed on that one occasion was a regular part of what went on at that facility, and that his dad worked there for, I don't know, what was it, 10 years or something?
And that's just not true. That's not what the record says.
Okay, what does the record say on that point?
The record says that only in a major overhaul situation, and I think the citation to that is ER 417, the only evidence is that it is in a major overhaul situation that asbestos might be disturbed, and it depends on how the operation was conducted by those who were operating at that time. That's the evidence. The evidence is not, as plaintiff suggests, that there was constant repair work going all the time that, in fact, disturbed the asbestos. There's no evidence to that.
So remind me then the expert's testimony as to causation. Well, you're going to get to that, I assume, because what I'm trying to remember is the expert says, I think that whatever this exposure, this sort of secondary exposure that the plaintiff suffered, would have been enough to constitute a substantial factor. But I can't remember what was the factual premise.
There was an assumption. That
what was the assumption?
The assumption was that he was constantly exposed. And that's the problem. And that's the baton was never passed to the expert. The experts, as all your honors know, their opinions are only as good as the factual basis for the opinions.
Right.
And there was no factual basis for the experts' opinions that, assuming he was constantly exposed.
So just help me with that.
Sure.
The expert was asked to assume or did assume that the father was exposed on a daily basis to
regularly,
this?
I think. Yeah,
regularly.
I think
okay.
That was his, or some word like that was his assumption. And of course, the other problem with the expert testimony was Dr. Churg said, well, he would need, and I'm about to get into this second topic, which is the substantial factor issue, that he would need industrial hygiene testimony to talk about intensity, proximity, duration, things like that, in order to come to his conclusions. And he didn't have any, and he wasn't given any. So that's my segue into substantial factor. Even speculating that there was exposure to the father, and even speculating that the plaintiff then picked up that exposure on the porch while his mother did the laundry.
I think that was the expert. They had an expert who said that it wasn't just going to be exposure on the porch, because the father, I think kept on the shirt, and so the whole house basically would have been contaminated.
He said that his testimony was that, assuming the father traipsed through the house and disturbed the assumed fibers on the clothing, that might be the case. But the actual testimony is that the father went to the porch and deposited his clothes on the porch.
I think the coveralls, but he had the shirt he would have been wearing, and I think he kept on in the house.
There's no testimony that somehow the fibers, these mythical fibers that didn't happen anyway, got from the overalls into the shirt.
I thought they were overalls so that the shirt would have been exposed.
Well,
that's what I was assuming, but yeah, okay.
The point you're making, Your Honor, is that all of this is speculation, and inferences can only be drawn if they're reasonable inferences, and if the inference is more likely than not. And we don't have enough evidence in the record to draw an inference more likely than not, for example, of what you're just suggesting. But getting back to substantial factor, even if you assume all of that exposure, exposure is not enough. There has to be evidence of, and without speculation, that the exposure was a substantial factor, meaning exposure amount and duration, intensity, proximity, things like that. And there's zero evidence in the record as to duration, proximity, and intensity of the exposure to the father,
well,
let alone...
What you're calling speculation is often what we would call dispute of fact, because we don't know what conclusions a jury would reach if the version that I thought we had from the record was that the father came home covered in dust, took off the overalls, they were washed on the porch, but walked through the house with his shirt on, covered with dust. Would that be not sufficient to show duration and proximity, but sufficient to at least get to the jury with the question of whether this was adequate proximity and duration? Do you see what I mean? I'm distinguishing between what you're calling speculation and whether there is sufficiency for the jury to make that decision.
Sure. And that's why I was talking about an inference, because the record is extremely limited and actually doesn't support the hypothetical that you propose. There is no actual testimony that the husband, or the father rather, whatever the dust was, and we don't know that it was asbestos dust, that's the first problem and the first speculative inference you have to get over, but whatever the dust was that he traipsed through the house, there's no evidence of that. The only evidence is from the plaintiff that the father deposited the clothing on the porch. And he may or may not have been there more than once. We don't know. He didn't remember. So, yes, there is absolutely a distinction in the law between circumstantial evidence and enough to get to a jury. But in this record, we are on the other side of the line where inferences cannot be drawn more likely than not based on the evidence in the record. And the exposure itself, as I started to say, even if you assume that happened, and it was actually asbestos exposure, zero evidence in the record on the son's proximity, intensity, duration, et cetera, which would allow the trier of fact, beyond speculation, to find a substantial factor, and particularly emphasizing the McIndoe case in that regard.
I was actually just going to ask you to address the McIndoe case, because, of course, that's applying federal common law. What would the standard be under Idaho law?
My understanding is that Idaho law employs a substantial factor test, but it hasn't been particularly articulated in the context of an asbestos case. But I would say that the McIndoe standard, which, although it was under maritime law, is applicable here because negligence standards applied, and the McIndoe court clearly articulated the substantial factor approach in an asbestos liability setting. And as Your Honor knows, that in the McIndoe case, the actual evidence of actual exposure was hugely greater than it is on this record. And even in that context, the McIndoe court said it's not enough because of the absence of information on proximity, duration, intensity. I know I'm running out of time, but quickly, Your Honor, did raise the issue of foreseeability, and we think under the Henry case, the court can't affirm on that basis alone, and I would simply point the court to the Henry case where it says whether a party owed a general duty of care with respect to a particular injury will depend on whether or not that injury was a foreseeable result of the party's action. And in this case, we're talking about the injury of mesothelioma. And as Your Honors have noted, and as the plaintiffs have conceded, or appellants have conceded, there is no evidence that before 1960 there were any studies connecting take-home exposure with mesothelioma. So under the Henry standard, we think as a matter of law, there can't be a finding of foreseeability. Okay. Unless Your Honors have any questions.
Nope. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Let's put 2 minutes on the clock for rebuttal. You ate far into your 5 minutes, so but we'll give you a couple.
I appreciate that. Judge Rothstein, ER 2829 is the reference. It was a statement from the court on the bench that it was an issue of fact, as I understood it. In the Hoyt case, none of the industrial hygiene literature that I talked to the court was before Judge Zille in Hoyt. There have been some fast and loose statements with the record. It wasn't one time. It was multiple times that he was there. The evidence supports the statement that, and Mr. Stevens' testimony is pretty succinct. I would commend it to the court, simply stating that that his father's shirt was dusty and he was around during that time.
What about the regularity of the asbestos removal work?
Well, the regularity, the inference is, and the record does not support the statement that it was only major overhauls by the corporate representative.
What else do we have?
Yeah, I mean, the evidence was that this, we have the specification from Union Pacific regarding the use of asbestos in the course of maintenance.
Let me ask my question.
Please. Okay. Thank you, John.
I'm just trying to give you a chance to respond.
I appreciate that.
The regularity of the activity that your client witnessed, right, removal of asbestos, because if we do have evidence that asbestos was in the insulation. So if that activity was a regular occurrence at your client's father's workplace, it seems to me you've got obviously a something to work with. But I think your opponent is right that if you can't establish that that was something that happened with some frequency, then the chain of inferences becomes a lot more speculative.
So I agree with that, Judge.
What do we have specific
sure.
regularity?
Sure. So, yeah, and what we have is, he saw it a half dozen times. That would not, I would concede, be regularity. But I believe it supports an inference in conjunction with Union Pacific's corporate representative statement that insulation removal was part of regular maintenance to support the inference.
What do you have an ER site for that?
Yeah.
Because your opponent says that no, all we admitted was that only during major overhauls would that activity occur.
And I would simply commend the court to the record. The record would ER 339 to 41, ER 303 to 04, and ER 416 to 4 to. And then ER 478 to 80.
Yeah. Okay.
With respect to the intensity of exposure, let's just be clear, there was no Daubert hearing. There was no effort to exclude the experts. There's no evidence. There was no indication that the district court looked to the expert testimony, which under Idaho law should have been deferred to. Finally, Dr. Churg's statement regarding the industrial hygienist only related to exposure that Mr. Stevens would have personally sustained in the roundhouse, not in the home. Dr. Churg found that was a substantial factor, and Dr. Longo found that was chronic. And again, under Idaho law, experts' conclusions drawn from the facts should be deferred to There's no evidence that either the Union Pacific evidence or the experts were looked to by the district court in rendering judgment here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Case just argued is submitted.